Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome back. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and you're listening to Chef Story. And today we're talking to Tony Maws up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We're on location in case you hear some restaurant noise in the background. And for those of you who might not have the pleasure of being in Cambridge and eating at Craigie on Main, Tony is one of the most awarded chefs up here in the New England area. James Beard Award winner, all the magazines, all the press here just adore him. And Food and Wine in 2005 called him one of America's top 10 best new chefs. So, you know, Tony, once again, happy to be here. Let's get back to it.
You bet.
So, after France, after a life of adolescent cooking,
yep,
professionally, how did you get to Craigie on Main? You know, what brought you here? Was it here and you became the chef?
No.
You raised the funding?
Yeah.
But what were the key mentors going along the way?
I really point to Chris Schlesinger.
Great guy.
Awesome guy. East Coast Grill. And then back then he owned the Blue Room, also in Cambridge. And, it's kind of weird that these days not a lot of the young culinary people like know who Chris is, but he was really a pioneer for American cooking.
Yeah.
In the sense that he had no fear. He was doing a type of cooking that hadn't been done, and that's really hard to do. Like in a time where everyone was doing this sort of continental cooking and that sort of same, you'd see a lot of the same things in the 80s. This guy went out on a limb and decided that he was going to cook everything on hardwood, and he was going to bring in ingredients from like Southeast Asia and Central America. And today that sounds unbelievably common. But that's all because of what Chris did. And he was a phenomenal teacher. And we had a lot of fun cooking there. And there was always a lot of energy, really just tremendous creative energy, because we were always trying stuff. And I got, I worked for him long enough where I got myself in a position where I was one of the people who got to try stuff. You know, the Friday, Saturday special off of the grill would be like mine. So that was an unbelievable opportunity. And he was, while he's a great guy, he was hard to work for, but in a very respectful way. I remember one thing where he said, you know, Tony, I need you to clean the storeroom. And I kind of looked at him and I said, okay. And he said, no, but you're going to clean the storeroom because I'm your boss. And then he walked away. And I was like, yes, sir. You know, yes, chef. But we didn't call him chef. He was still Chris. But it was a fun place to work. It was high energy and high intensity.
What did you learn there?
To experiment and to go out on a limb. And I learned a lot just practically about hardwood cooking, which we don't do here at Craigie on Main, but we'll probably do in my next place. But it was just a tremendous organization.
And who else influenced you?
Mark Miller. Mark is awesome. Mark's a Boston boy, so I didn't know him in Boston,
really?
But that's
okay, but
definitely
he's
something.
In Southwest. He is so, Mr.
Yeah.
Southwest
he is,
for all you youngins out there.
So, but
he
he's also
iconic.
He is one of the original Chez Panisse cooks.
Yes,
which also gets, I think, overlooked all the time. I mean, he was in the kitchen with Judy Rogers and Jeremiah Tower, and I was working for Chris, and my time was up there, and I had done a good job. And Chris said, "Tell me who you want to work for. I'll send you there." And I had been working with this live fire, and I thought that the next, extension was to go work for Mark. So he sent me to Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I got the job and had an unbelievable year in Santa Fe. It's a very, obviously it's a special place, but it was a special kitchen. We had a really good group of people there. And then I ended up in San Francisco, and I kept on sort of just pointing to restaurants that I thought were doing a good job, regardless of style. I ended up at La Folie in San Francisco under Roland Passot.
That's so different than Mark Miller. That's like I got polar opposite.
Exactly. I got the town, and a guy, a friend of a friend of a friend, was, and this world is, we're all connected. Richard Reddington, who now is a great restaurant, Red, and he had worked for Roland for a long time, and said, if you want to learn how to cook, this is a great learning kitchen. It was small. It was, and when I say, I've now used the word intense too many times, but this was like the epitome of that. It was hard. And Roland
very
was,
French.
Yes, and Roland is on the line every night, and on the line physically.
Emotionally.
Emotionally, like slamming his hand down on the counter, like, oh la la, you know. Frequently calling us stupid Americans, you know, but in a kind of in a loving, odd way.
Yeah.
And I got to work side by side with him. It was just this incredible experience. And that
where
almost
did you
was
learn
my
the business? You know, not the cooking. To run a place like this, this is just a really well-run business.
Thank you.
You've got your staff. I mean, your staff is beautiful.
Honestly,
energy here
whatever my business acumen is, wherever it comes from, I got to really point that to my parents. I mean, they were both entrepreneurs. They both own their own businesses. They both were successful. They both taught me about work ethic. My mom, especially, who's involved in this business, has been an incredible resource and role model and idol. And I know that, you know, moms are in their own way, but she sort of surpassed that. And she's a butt kicker, too. And she's my harshest critic in a very loving way. And I think because of our approach, we sort of attracted people who wanted to do it the right way too. So I've always been fortunate to work with like the best accountant, the best bookkeeper, and had really good advisors. And my approach for me, even though I would learn a lot of things the hard way by doing it myself, was to, you know, be true to myself and do it the right way.
So when you,
I'm honest,
when you open Craigie on me.
So we know, well, I opened Craigie Street Bistro first.
Ah.
So I gathered, you know,
did
whatever.
Did you have to get the investors?
We gathered pennies, and I borrowed some money from my parents, my mom, and we opened up Craigie Street Bistro. I mean, we purchased this existing restaurant in this basement of this apartment building with, like, no parking spots.
In Cambridge?
In Cambridge. It's in the Harvard Square side. And we were there for 6 years, and you know, for just under a couple $100,000, which is nothing, which is pennies. We purchased it, and then I opened it for $15,000.
What was your vision for it?
When I was in France, I was spending time, you know, like I said, going to Paris, and it was just about the same time that Jeffrey Steingarten wrote his first book, and then there was his description of the Bistro Moderne, which were all these guys, girls, coming out of Michelin-starred restaurants, giving their finger to the system, and saying, I'm going to buy these little places. I'm going to buy the same ingredients. I'm going to use the same techniques that I've been taught, but I'm not going to put it on fancy china. I'm not going to buy thousands of dollars worth of flowers. I'm going to cook food. That's what I'm going to do. And people responded. And when I was in Paris and eating at La Regula and Osso Moel and Lepi Dupin and stuff like that, it just sort of dawned on me. Like, this is not what I want to copy. This is me. This is who I am. People have heard me say this before. I'm a jeans and t-shirt guy. But I love champagne, caviar, and foie gras. And I didn't understand why I had to be at Le Bristol or Le Maurice to do that. And I love those restaurants for what they are, but I don't think that that's the only way you have to have that kind of food or those ingredients in your food. So I began to really think, like, you know, what does this mean? So Craigie Street Bistro was my first way of sort of saying that. Like, nothing matched. All our silverware didn't match. The plates didn't match. I couldn't afford anything that was going to do that. I reused all the tables and chairs from the restaurant that was there before us. I even used their big bulky plates. I had this Wolf range that was 25 years old that broke down every single Saturday night. You know, it was crazy. It was madness. And I cooked. Like, I just cooked. I thought, you know, I had been working at Clio and
how big was your crew in the kitchen?
Starting?
Yeah.
When we opened up Craigie Street Bistro, it was me, one cook who came and hung over every single day, and one dishwasher. And after
it must have been real good if you could stand up to you hungover. How many covers a night would you do?
Well, so in the early days, it wasn't so much. I mean, we were only 40 plus seats, and we were doing, like, you know, 60, and it'd be big if we did like 70 covers. And then Gourmet Magazine came in when they were still Gourmet Magazine and called us their editor's pick.
Ooh, was that when Ruth was there?
Of the city. Ruth was there. Ooh. She was not the one in the restaurant.
That was kind of huge.
We were the editor's pick for the city, and all of a sudden the phone started ringing off the hook, and we said, uh-oh, I think I need another cook. So we quickly sort of expanded the you know, the employee base, both front and back of the house, and people were coming all over the place. And we didn't have a bar for people to wait in. We had nothing, but people kept on coming.
But you were there for 6 years.
I was there for 6 years.
So then, was that what said, okay, let's do this right, or let's expand? How did Craig Young make
I might argue about? We were doing it right.
No. I mean, with the bar outside.
Yeah, so we had an opportunity. Like, after a bunch of those years, and Food and Wine called. I still remember the call from Dana Cowan. It was actually a funny story. Do I have time to tell you a funny story? Okay, so some of you might know Pete Wells,
who is
now the dining critic for the New York Times. And back then, he was a freelance writer. And he wrote this article about Grant Atkins when Alinea was just about to open up. And it was a great article. But it was also sort of, my interpretation of this article was that he was saying that you kind of needed to be this kind of restaurant. This was going to be the next great restaurant, and all great restaurants were going to be like this. And I got really pissed off because I was really proud of what I was doing in this little basement of mine. And, you know, we were doing riffs on classical stuff, but doing our own thing too. And I thought it was delicious food. So how do you define best, and how do you define what's going to be next and great? So I actually wrote a letter to the editor, Food and Wine, saying, I'm pissed. You know, how do you compare these things? Like, what is great? What I just said. So I remember being in my little kitchen, and the phone on the wall had caller ID, and the phone rang, and it said American Express, and that's, of course. I don't know how I put the two together. I just knew that Food and Wine is owned by American Express.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, great. You know, like, I don't get this phone call on the kitchen line.
Yeah.
So I picked it up. Hello, you know, is Tony there? Yeah, this is Tony. Hi, this is Dana Cowan from Food and Wine. I'm like, oh, shit. You know, like I said, like, am I in trouble?
And you should have known better. You're the head of Food and Wine, not to call me during service.
Yeah, right? I'm like, am I in trouble? Did you get my letter? And she goes, letter? Oh, yeah, your letter to the editor. Yeah, in fact, we're actually going to publish it. And I said, oh, okay.
Thank you.
Thanks. And she says, well, just to show you that's not what we think, congratulations, you're one of our best new chefs this year. Like, I dropped the phone out of my hand. You know, I was like, what?
So they had been secret shopping you.
Exactly.
Oh, wow.
So that's my funny story.
What a great story.
But it's...
So that was back at the bistro.
That was back at the bistro, and we were just working our tails off, just trying to do it the right way. You know, we didn't have a lot of bells and whistles there either. I used to have to send... We had these rooms down the hall in the basement of this apartment building that were these closets for the apartments, and as people would move out, we would take over their closet so I could have more space. And we had circulators plugged in on, like, you know, 50 feet of extension cord and, you know, all these other refrigerators that we could finally fit back there to, you know, store some of our stuff. And it was madness. But we had a great time cooking there. But
all right,
that
we're gonna
led
take,
us to Craig Young Main.
We're going to take another break. And when we come back, we're going to hear all about Craig Young Main.
Sure.
Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards and Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surifarms.com.
Okay, we're back. And today we're talking to Tony Maas, owner, chef extraordinaire of Craig Young Main and a new place to come, which we're going to talk about. But right now we're moving from the bistro to what was the vision for Craig Young Main? Why did you obviously loved that bistro.
I did, and there are parts about it that I'll always miss.
Yeah.
There are parts about it that I'll never miss. You know, it was tough working in this basement, and I think that when we began to actually get a little bit of confidence that maybe we were going to be okay at this thing, we also began to realize that, you know, we say no to so many people there. We said no to parking because we didn't have it. We said no to being able to serve people a cocktail because we only had beer and wine. We said no to people being able to wait for a table because there was literally nowhere for people to wait. We couldn't do large parties. We I mean, no. And even tasting menus, like if I wasn't getting crushed in the kitchen, I could do tasting menus. But if I was getting crushed in this shoebox of the kitchen, I couldn't do the tasting menus. It just didn't work. So we said, well, maybe we can do a restaurant. Maybe we can do a restaurant that's going to have a bar, that's going to have a place for people to park, where people can wait. That'll have a kitchen that I can actually try to do some of the things that I've been dreaming about doing, and not change my personality about who we are about food, but just do it better. You know, we believe in something called Kaizen, which is a Japanese term. It means continual improvement. So my next step in my Kaizen was to put myself in a position to do that. And we stumbled across an, you know, sort of iconic building in Central Square. It had been a great red sauce Italian place since 1971 called La Grosseria. And the family that owned the building owned the restaurant, and they were sort of tired of running the restaurant. And we literally just walked in and said, not knowing that at the time, like saying, we'd love your restaurant. How about you sell it to us? And they said, yeah. They said, people have been asking for years, and we weren't ready, and now we're ready. And we looked at this old, it's actually two storefronts that have now been connected. And, you know, the building was built in the early 1800s. There are pictures of this building with the original red line being dug outside of Main Street. That's the RT, the subway. And, you know, we're sort of like this old school kind of Cambridge, frumpy, I don't know, shabby chic kind of place. So like going to another old building, but that also has its own basement issues. We have those too. But it just seemed like a logical place. And we gutted it, and we raised the money, and we've got some tremendous note holders and a bank that's been very, very good to us. And, you know, a lot of people believed in us, and to this day,
I'm
humbled.
Was it easier to raise the money? I mean, there are a lot of wannabe cooks out there who want their own place.
No, it's
was
never
it because of... Here you had a 6-year track record.
Yeah.
You got every award that a young chef could, you know, possibly want.
But we're a dime a dozen. I mean, people had to believe in what we were doing, and they had to believe in what we were doing in actually the very beginning of the recession, which is pretty crazy.
Yeah.
When we actually signed the lease for this restaurant and began to raise funds, like the New York Times came out and said the world's going to end, you know, like everything's going to shit. So
that's when you raised the money for you?
Yeah. It was hard.
So how when you opened,
yep,
were you an immediate success?
Well, I mean, part of the whole recession thing, and that's like where the burger came from. I said, of course, I've got these grand images in my head of what I want to do, but I also own this business. And to be frank, you know, you guys should understand this out there. Like, my mortgage is on the line. Like, I had to pledge that. So that was a long conversation with my wife, you know. So I said, I gotta fill this restaurant. Like, I'll do tasting menus, but I got to make sure that people are coming and paying, because I got people to pay back, and I got my house to save. So we got the burger in the bar, and we do tasting menus throughout the restaurant, and we do pre-fees in other ways. And at one point, we had a bar menu. We were like, whatever we got to do, get them in. Like, whatever we got to do. So I think, you know, at that point...
Now you're going to do it again, right?
Now,
you're going to open a new restaurant?
I'm a masochist.
Now, is this... So this has been hugely successful.
We feel very lucky, yes.
Yes.
We work hard.
And you work hard, and it's just fantastic.
We've got good people here.
Why not just watch the Super Bowl tomorrow, you know, enjoy yourself? Why take the next restaurant step?
You know, everyone has asked for a long time, would I open up another restaurant? And my answer has always been no. I think it's one of those things, like, if someone's going to ask you, you're going to have a baby, and you're just not ready for that yet, but one of these days you just sort of figure you're gonna. I've got a great team in place here. There's another type of food that I want to cook. It's kind of like the food that I like to cook in my house on Mondays when I'm off with my family. Like, everything is really well prepared and well seasoned, but it's just simple and delicious. I love my restaurant. This is always going to be my baby, but I would love to do something that was a little bit more casual, a little bit more rustic, a little bit louder.
So this is the new restaurant.
This is the new restaurant.
Where is it going to be?
It's located right on the Cambridge and Somerville line, and it's so just a mile, a little over a mile from here. It's next door to this iconic Spanish tapas restaurant called Dali. It used to be called the Kirkland Cafe, and we're going to take over that spot. So we just signed our lease. And we're waiting for the license transfer to be approved. Then we'll start building probably in 2 or 3 months. So we're settling on a name. But it's going to be it's going to be fun. It's going to be, you know, great energy. It's going to be, I mean, Craig Yamane, I think, is a pretty low pretense restaurant for fine dining, and this is going to be a low pretense restaurant for casual dining. It's going to be our style. It's going to be awesome. There's going to be a lot of good roasted, grilled meat and fat. And
any interesting equipment you're putting in?
Just getting to thinking about that right now. I mean, I alluded, you know, I said before that I really loved cooking on live fire, and I miss that tremendously because we don't have that here, and I definitely want to incorporate that into the new place.
So, tell me, where you also have a great sense of responsibility to the community here.
Well,
where does that come? I mean, you do fundraising. You do,
I have a lot of people in my family who are pretty politically active. So maybe part of it's my own guilt of thinking like, well, what am I doing for the people? I get to cook for people every day, and I get to put a lot of smiles on people's faces, and I never take that for granted. That's really powerful. It's really tremendous. But I don't just look at the people who can afford to come to Craig Yamane as being part of that. Like, my community, I can't do what I'm doing in this place without Central Square. Or I can't do what I'm doing feeding people who can afford to be here without thinking about the people who can't afford to be here. And then when I had a son, 4.5 years ago, and I'm looking at this little person who I'm now responsible for feeding, it made me think very differently about food and who gets fed and when and how. So, I mean, there are tremendous charities out there in the world, but we've really focused a lot of our energies on Cambridge itself and things having to do with childhood hunger and food. You know, we do a lot of work with Share Our Strength. And...
okay, we've got the bartender, but that's okay. That's okay. We're in the restaurant. Here we go.
So we do a lot of work with Share Our Strength, and that's very important to us. And and then of course how we cook our food and some of the politics and philosophies that are very important to us. So, you know, chef's collaboratives and things like that.
Yeah. What do you think of the role of the chef politically? In the whole, I mean, I personally think more than any other sector, our chefs have done more for improving the food chain, helping mid-sized farmers, you know, exist because you can buy in bulk. I mean, how do you see, if you look 10 years down the road, can you give us any thoughts about what you think is going to change in food?
Oh, wow, that's a tremendous question. I mean, there's food is in the world of restaurants has been exposed in such a different way in the past decade. And I think that there's some things that I sort of get annoyed about. I mean, I don't really enjoy being in the spotlight. And those are words that you were mentioning. I mean, they're really nice and they are good for morale for my staff, and everyone here has worked really hard. So I guess the best way that I know how to use that is to try to do, you know, something good. And I think in that sense, that's what chefs can do. I don't think it's necessarily my responsibility. I don't know if that's for everybody. But if I can, I'm gonna, and how that transforms. I mean, you just see it with how interested people are with food right now, and if there's a trend getting back to real ingredients and pork that actually tastes like pork, so it wasn't engineered to taste like something different, and, you know, fish that is being sustainably raised. There's nothing wrong with that. So if I can influence that in any way, shape, or form, and I'm not trying to be hippy-dippy about it. I don't want to bring my politics to everybody. And I don't know how green of a restaurant we are. I feel like I just have my own moral compass that I want to abide by and do things the right way.
Well, I think on that, you're quite an inspiration. And
hopefully
thank
my
you.
Grandmother and my grandfather think I'm doing okay.
I think they'd be very proud. Thanks for the interview today.
You bet. Thank you very much.
All right. Can I get a reservation?
Maybe.
Okay. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.